So today I'm going to do something I really should not do. Except for the fact that this course is called Research Skills, which means I can do anything the heck I want because no one knows what it means. But I really should not do it because what I'm about to tell you, first of all, the people who are going to come teach you quantum field theory will hate me for doing this. And secondly, in a sense, you won't be able to fully appreciate how remarkable some of these things are without suffering through the standard way of doing them. Okay? So, you know, think of this as a morning in fantasy land. And then you'll wake up tomorrow and, you know, have a funny pain at the side of your head. But then when you're sitting there smack in the middle of a long Feynman diagram calculation, you'll have these flashes to, wait a minute, isn't there some other way of doing this? Oh, okay. So what I want to tell you about is what begins as, what we're going to talk about today are how to more correctly think about and compute these objects that have been that have come up over and over again in these lectures, which are scattering amplitudes in a relativistic theory. Okay. I emphasized a number of times that because of gravity, the only thing that we can the only kinds of perfectly well-defined quantities that we can imagine talking about are, in flat space anyway, are scattering amplitudes. Now again, the degree of imprecision with which we talk about the local observables is very, very, very small. It was this thing of order e to the minus the entropy of the black hole that would eat up the region in which the local measurement is made. But be that as it may, if you want to talk about perfectly, perfectly well-defined things in the theory that's flat space at minus infinity and the flat space at plus infinity, the only thing we can talk about is the S matrix. Someone asked this question a little earlier, I forget who it was who asked this question yesterday. But of course, in the S matrix, there's tons and tons of information that we normally associate with local physics. For example, someone asked, do you see the hydrogen atom in the S matrix? The answer is absolutely you see the hydrogen atom in the S matrix. If you collide electrons and protons, the hydrogen atom, or any stable particle at all, shows up because, as we saw yesterday, there are these propagator factors. These propagator factors really show up in the S matrix. And if you have a particle of mass m, they should show up like that. If the particle is an exactly stable particle of mass m, it should show up like that. So in a world where the proton is exactly stable, very likely not our world, actually, but if we ignore the tiny probability that the proton might decay, then the hydrogen atom would show up as a pole in the electron-proton S matrix at the location p squared minus m electron plus m proton minus the binding energy, really the mass of the hydrogen atom, or the ground state would show up as such a pole. Okay? And it's an honest-to-goodness actual pole in the amplitude. The excited states don't necessarily show up at poles because the excited states aren't stable exactly. Okay. And so resonances, roughly speaking, show up in the Bright-Wigner way as 1 over p squared minus m squared plus im gamma, where gamma is like the width of the state. Okay. Yes?
So an accelerator doesn't talk about resonances that are actually like particles that are formed with the KB4. You know, they're not stable on the length scale of...
Yes, exactly. Now, actually, this is strictly speaking not correct, although this technicality will not affect anything I'm saying at all. But just so I say something strictly correct, one actually doesn't see this pole on what's known as the physical sheet of the scattering amplitude, which actually has a branch cut. One has to go underneath the branch cut to the second Riemann sheet to see this pole. But anyway, you can completely ignore that remark. But anyway, so there is even some way of seeing unstable particles in the S matrix. And this is true, by the way, with or without gravity. So, you know, if I wanted to weigh a hydrogen atom here, if I want to weigh a hydrogen atom in this room, tough shit. Okay, there is an irreducible uncertainty to any measurement of the mass of the hydrogen atom that I would get out by performing that measurement in this room. But there's another measurement that I can do, which is collide electrons and positrons and protons from infinity, have them go back out to infinity, and find the location of the pole of the S matrix. That's a perfectly well-defined quantity, and that's the kind of experiment that can return to me, in principle, an arbitrarily accurate mass for the hydrogen atom and for every other part. Okay? So of course, the S matrix contains the information about things going in and out of infinity. Indirectly, it contains some information that you might normally associate with measuring in other ways. But the only truly precise way of computing these things is by studying the properties of what comes in from infinity and goes out from infinity. Okay. So now, because gravity is making the S matrix the only sharp observable, it is interesting to focus on calculating it, even if you don't care about gravity. Okay? Because when you turn on even a little bit of gravity, this is the only observable you have left. Of course, also, the really practical reason people talked about scattering amplitudes is that's the kind of experiments we do in particle physics all the time. Okay? We scatter particles in, things come out, and we try to learn something about what happened. So let me just formally tell you, I'm going to focus in these lectures on the scattering amplitude for massless particles. And let me fix some notation. So again, normally when we talk about a scattering process, we imagine some particles coming in from minus infinity and going out to plus infinity. Okay. So we do that. So we have the incoming particles, which have some four momentum, p mu, so has some energy incoming and momenta incoming, and similarly for the outgoing particles. And in this way of defining things, of course, all the energies are positive. Okay. But in fact, it's very useful to talk about this in a way that doesn't make a distinction between past and future, and imagines, let's say, that all the particles are incoming or outgoing. So let's just imagine that they're all incoming. That means if all the particles are incoming, that some of the momenta are associated, have negative energies, some have positive energies. But if you want to get from this object, the object that corresponds to what you want, all you do is interpret some of the negative energy incoming particles as positive energy outgoing antiparticles. Okay? So there's a very simple map between the amplitude of all momenta incoming and the thing that you're actually interested in, okay? Which is something's physically interested in. Something's going in, something's going out. But it's much more convenient to talk about the case with all the momenta incoming. Okay? Now I don't have to make any distinction between in and out in labeling this up. Okay, so let's say that all of these particles are scalars. If all these particles are scalars, then what is this amplitude mathematically? It's a function of n momenta, if there's n particles, n four momenta, right? 1, 2, n. Okay. And under Lorentz transformations, how does it behave? Under Lorentz transformations, these particles are scalars, so it should be that if I Lorentz transform lambda p 1 and lambda p n, that this is just equal to m of p 1 up to pn. So if someone hands you a function of n variables, this is how you check and claims that it's an amplitude for many for the scattering of many scalars. It had better be, first of all, so actually let me make one thing manifest. So let me call this object script m. Okay. Well, first of all, script m of p1 up to pn had better be 0 unless these particles conserve momentum. So you have to have a delta function that imposes that momentum is conserved. Momentum conservation is simply the sum of all the momenta is equal to 0, okay? Because they're all incoming. And then whatever is left, let's call capital M. And as I said, Lorentz transformations are just a statement that M of lambda p 1 up to lambda p n is equal to m of p 1 up to p n, if they're scalars. Now, as we said yesterday, massless particles in four dimensions, in general, they're not scalars, don't have spin, but instead just have helicity. And the helicity can be plus s or minus s for whatever the spin of the particle is at, half, one, three halves, two, or whatever. Okay? So a general amplitude is labeled by a bunch of helicities and a bunch of momenta. Yes?
I'm a little confused on the difference between script n and non-script n here.
Sorry. Script m is the actual amplitude.
Okay.
And this is just saying that the actual amplitude, first of all, vanishes unless momentum is conserved. Okay. And whatever multiplies that is what I'm calling capital M. So just so I don't carry this delta function around all the time, I'm just going to talk about this capital M. Okay.
All right. Thank you.
Okay, so again, this is particle H1 and P1 up to HN and PN. Now, how should this behave under Lorentz transformations? That's something a few of you were here earlier, and we were here in the afternoon yesterday, and we talked about this at great length. Those of you who weren't here for it can talk to them about it if you want more detail. But the result is so intuitive that I'll just state it. Okay. What happens is this: if I Lorentz transform the momenta, I should no longer get exactly. This back. Okay. The reason is the particles have some spin. So, for example, here's just trivially, let's say you do a Lorentz transformation that happens to be a rotation around the direction in which one of the particles is moving. Just a normal rotation. Then clearly you should pick up a phase factor, an e to the I times the spin of the particle times theta phase factor associated with that. Okay. And so that's, in fact, the general answer. The general answer is that what you get is the product of some e to the I theta I times the spin of the particle, I, where the theta is depends on what the Lorentz transformation is. An e to the I theta that depends on the Lorentz transformation and the momentum pi times the spin of the particle, si. It's helicity, hi. And it's the e to the sum of these things. Now, how precisely you build this rotation, if I hand you a given Lorentz transformation, is something we talked about yesterday afternoon. But for the purpose of this lecture, it's actually not going to matter very, very much. I just want you to see something important here, though. The amplitude is not something which is like a Lorentz tensor. Like, if you have a bunch of spin 1 particles, the amplitude is not like, it doesn't have mu indices. It has helicity indices, because the particles have helicity. Okay? So this is an interesting kind of object. It has to have the property that when you transform a Lorentz transform, the momenta, you multiply it by some phase factors. Okay? Okay. All right, so that's what we have to calculate. And if someone hands you some amplitude and says, this is an amplitude for the scattering of a spin 1 and a spin 3 and all these particles. Well, we said yesterday spin 3 is impossible, but anyway, all these massless particles, then the first check that you have to do is that it has the correct Lorentz transformation property. So you have to check that it transforms like this. Okay. Now, even though you probably haven't learned about Feynman diagrams or anything like that, and you will soon, this is why my future colleagues will hate me. Let me quickly sketch out how one goes ahead and does this computation in the standard formulation of field theory. My colleagues are going to hate me because I'm telling you about a non-standard, hasn't quite been developed yet, is in the process of being understood, alternate way of thinking about quantum field theory, which you're not going to, as I said, appreciate so much until you learn the standard way, except that you're going to be very annoyed with your professors in a few weeks when you see how horribly difficult things are when you do them like this. It's so tremendously easy. But you should pay attention to them. They're wonderful people and so on. Yes?
So M is the nap to the scattering amplitude?
M is the scattering amplitude.
Yes.
Yeah. Is it completely clear what this amplitude is? I mean, you know, it's like literally put in the states with these momenta at minus infinity. I evolve with the Hamiltonian and the usual way of doing things. I get some state at plus infinity, and it's just the overlap of that state at plus infinity, the state at minus infinity. Okay. So that's what it is. Okay. So the usual way of doing this is that you draw Feynman diagrams. Okay? So you draw Feynman diagrams. So let's say I want to have a process with two electrons, an electron and a positron goes to three photons. Then you draw Feynman diagrams that looks like this. And then there's a bunch of diagrams. And you have to add up all the diagrams. Now, in the simplest cases that you do in textbooks, one very rarely looks at cases, in fact, in textbooks, almost never looks at cases involving more than two particles in, two particles out, or more than four particles total. And in those cases, the number of Feynman diagrams you write down is relatively manageable. 1, 2, 3. Then you have to learn to sit down and calculate them. Okay? So very good. There are rules. You calculate them. Everything is fine. But, and this is a very important point, the rules assign to all, if this is a photon, it assigns vector, normal Lorentz vector indices to all of these particles. So there's a mu one for this particle, for that photon, for this photon, mu two, for this photon, mu three, and so on. Okay. The reason is that what you're really doing when you compute these Feynman diagrams is imagining that you're getting them from a Hamiltonian, or really in the end, when you do it nicely, from a Lagrangian, which are made out of fields in spacetime. The fields have normal Lorentz indices, a mu of x. Okay. So let's in fact say we're just talking about spin one particles, scattering of the spin one particles. Okay. Then what a Feynman diagram computation gives you is actually something that looks like this. Okay? It gives you things that are labeled by Lorentz indices. That is not the actual physical amplitude. Okay? To get the actual physical amplitude, what you have to do is get this thing that you get out of Feynman diagrams, and you have to dot it into the polarization vectors. Okay? So you say, I have to dot this with the polarization vector epsilon 1 mu 1 for particle of helicity 1. Epsilon mu 2, particle of helicity 2. This depends on the momentum, right? P1, P2, and so on. Epsilon mu n hn of pn multiplied by m mu 1 up to m mu n. Okay? And then you say, okay, everything is great because under Lorentz transformations, this guy just transforms like a normal tensor, right? This thing transforms, that thing transforms. So you say, okay, that's very good. I should just invent a polarization vector, epsilon mu, which also under normal Lorentz transformations will transform the mu indices correctly, but which will also multiply by a phase. Okay, in order for it to give me the Lorentz transformation I actually want. The trouble is, as we discussed yesterday, there is no such thing as that polarization vector. Okay? There's no such thing as a polarization vector that under Lorentz transformations does that. Yes?
Is this the case as well for massless particles that Feynman diagrams need to be done?
Yes, always, always. Feynman diagrams always give you this. Okay? Feynman diagrams always give you this, and then you have to dot into polarization vectors. Okay? It's just that for massive particles, nice polarization vectors exist, which have the property that you want. For massless particles, they really don't exist. There's no such thing. There is absolutely no such thing as a polarization vector for a spin one particle that has the property that under a Lorentz transformation, I mean, the property that we'd want it to have is that under a Lorentz transformation, right, that this is equal to lambda epsilon of p times e to the I theta of lambda of p, let's say, times the helicity. But if I'm doing spin one, it would just be times one. Okay? But no such object can exist. We just discovered that by counting yesterday, right? There's only two polarization vectors, and there's no Lorentz invariant condition that you can put on you can demand that it's orthogonal to p, and that knocks it down from 4 to 3. But there's no more conditions that you can put on it. And what happens is if you define polarization vectors in one reference frame, that's fine. When you do a Lorentz transformation on it, in the other reference frame, you'll get the polarization vector that you talked about, something that looked like this, plus something proportional to the momentum in the other reference frame. Okay. So these objects just don't exist. These polarization vectors don't exist. What you then have to do is what we said yesterday. You have to arrange your theory very, very, in a very special and careful way so that you get the same answer, whichever one of those polarization vectors you use, okay? Which was the requirement we discussed yesterday, that if you take one of these polarization vectors and replace them with the corresponding momentum, when you dot it into this thing that you get from Feynman diagrams, you better get zero, okay? But you see, this shows you something. This shows you that whatever the theory is which is calculating this, whatever the theory that's producing this mu, is carrying around lots of redundant baggage, right? Of course it's carrying lots of redundant baggage. It's propagating around lots of particles that actually, lots of degrees of freedom that aren't actually there, okay? It's carrying around 4 degrees of freedom to describe a massless spin one particle. There's only 2, okay? And it has to arrange itself in a very special way that actually it's redundant, that all those extra degrees of freedom, you know, disappear when you dot it into the physical polarization vectors. For this reason, most people, even when they compute amplitudes in beginning quantum field theory courses, they never see what one actually looks like. You only ever see it in this redundant form. Because what you do after you work very hard to compute the Feynman diagrams is you get m mu 1 up to mu n, and then you just leave the polarization vectors in there with the epsilons. And you're so exhausted by that point, you don't bother shoving in what the epsilons actually look like to get an idea of what the amplitude actually looks like. Sometimes what you might do is compute a cross-section. So you'll take the amplitude mod squared, and then you'll sum over all the states. So that's something, and you can get a feeling for what that looks like. But the actual amplitudes is rarely something you see in beginning courses. Well, because it's hard to see it. In fact, standard Feynman diagrams never let you see it. You only ever see it in this very redundant form, right? Where you, okay. Now, this is all fine. This is all fine. This redundancy is what really gauge symmetry is. It's what really diffeomorphism invariance is. Gauge symmetry for spin one, diffeomorphism invariance for spin two, as we said yesterday, are nothing other than these large amount of redundancies that let you talk about the interactions of these particles in a local way. But what's forcing us into all this redundancy in our description is our insistence on describing this, the physics for the scattering of spin one and spin two particles in a manifestly local way. Right? That's what we're trying to do. We build fields, Feynman diagrams, this entire apparatus that you're about to learn properly. The one thing that it's born to do is make locality completely manifest from the very start. Okay. However, all of this redundancy means something. It means that the Feynman diagram calculations, just as a practical matter, the Feynman diagram calculations start becoming tremendously complicated when you go beyond the very, very simplest processes. Just to give you an example, let's say you want to calculate, in QED, something like this would happen too, but let's say in the theory of the interaction of gluons, the strong interactions, these are a bunch of self-interacting massless spin one particles at very short distances, the gluons that hold the quarks together in the proton. But let's say you want to compute an amplitude, so I'll draw the gluons with squiggly lines like this. Let's say you want to compute an amplitude for the scattering of 6 gluons. Okay, is that 6? That's 6. Okay. So this is written in a really bad way. Is that 6? It's not 6, is it? That's why it looks so bad. There we go. Okay. Now, this could be a process of the sort that happens at this process happens at the LHC. Thousands, hundreds of thousands of times a second. Okay, 2 gluons go in, 4 gluons come out. Now, if you want to, so let's label these things 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6. Okay, these guys actually have colors, and so in fact, there is really a sense in which there's a cyclic ordering given by what the relevant colors are. Okay, so. So if you don't understand that, never mind. It's not very important for what I want to say, for the polemic point I'm about to make. The resulting expression isn't going to have full permutation symmetry under exchanging all of these guys, as you might think. If there were just photons, there would be, you know, Bose symmetry would tell you that you should be able to permute any of them and get the same answer. These guys actually have a label. And so all you'll see is a cyclic invariance of the thing only has a cyclic invariance. But anyway, that process at the lowest order in perturbation theory, where you would only draw diagrams that look like trees, Feynman diagrams that look like trees, involves 220 Feynman diagrams. And when you expand it out, it involves thousands and thousands of terms, maybe tens of thousands. I forget how many. But it doesn't fit on one page. You don't do this by hand. Okay? You could not possibly do this by hand. And furthermore, there is no, I mean, the resulting expression just has a bunch of polarization vector dot momenta, polarization vector dot momenta, you know, just a gigantic mass, multiple page mess in tiny print. Okay. However, when you actually look at the final amplitude, you find there are some a shocking simplicity to the actual answer. And the shocking simplicity actually depends on what the helicities are. So for example, it turns out that the cases where all the helicities are positive, that this vanishes. So all these 220 diagrams and thousands of terms add up to zero. Okay? You find that when five of them are positive and one of them is negative, you find that that also vanishes. The first thing that doesn't vanish is like when two of them are negative helicity and the rest are positive helicity. Okay? And in this case, and this is you won't know what this notation means yet, but I just want to write down the answer. And then you'll see what the notation means in a second. In this case, the amplitude is given by a one-line expression. Okay. Feynman diagrams are doing something terribly wrong. In the case where there are three negative helicities, there's a slightly more complicated formula that involves three terms. Okay? In the case where there are four negative helicities, oh wait, this is just the same as the case that we talked about a second ago with two negative helicities, except I switch negative and positive. Okay? It turns out that, so let's say I do this configuration. So 3 and 5 are positive. Then in this case, the amplitude is just exactly of the same form. You see, this 4, 6 were the two special guys that were negative before. So I use these funny angle brackets that will tell I'll tell you what they mean in a second. But anyway, I just do exactly the same thing here. 3 and 5 were the special guys. And I use another kind of funny bracket called square brackets. Okay. And that's it. In the case where five of them are negative helicity, it vanishes. Where six of them are negative helicity, it vanishes. Okay. In fact, there's an infinite class of amplitudes which involve any number of positive helicity particles. Mostly positive, and only some two negative. So let's say particle I is negative and particle J is negative, but all the rest of them are positive. These are called maximally helicity violating amplitudes, or MHV amplitudes. They're the first ones that are non-zero, because for any number of external particles, all positive helicity gluons is zero, and all but one is zero. And this is just the obvious generalization of this formula. It's ij to the fourth over 1, 2, 2, 3, up to n1. So in this case, this is for Yang-Mills theory. Okay, so this is something where you will probably at some point in a quantum field theory course compute an amplitude for gluon-gluon scattering, which is just this case. Okay. In no quantum field theory course will anyone force you to calculate a scattering amplitude involving gravitons. Oh, so let me back up a second. Let me back up just to make my story a little more dramatic. You normally start in a field theory course by doing simple-looking quantum field theories, like phi to the 4 theory, some theory of scalar fields. Okay. And you think this is a simple case. You warm up, you learn all about it, and then with a heavy heart, you proceed to starting to talk about spin 1 particles, or fermions, heaven forbid, and then spin 1 particles. Okay. And then your heart gets so heavy that you barely even look at a spin 2 particle, because you're already drowning in indices in spin 1. It's a tremendous mess. Okay. And then if you're ever brave enough to crack open a book on doing perturbation theory for scattering amplitudes in general relativity, you're immediately punished because, you know, even the Feynman rule for 3 gravitons, for 3 gluons like that, okay, this is not terrible. I forget what it is. It involves 3 terms, okay? This analogous Feynman rule for gravity involves 80 terms, okay? And that's just for that one. At least Yang-Mills theory has the decency to only have these interactions. Okay, gravity has an infinite number of interactions. The simplest one has 80 terms, and the next one has, I forget, how many terms. So Feynman diagram calculations in gravity are horrendously, horrendously complicated. In fact, there was an absolutely heroic tour de force calculation back in the 60s that computed the 4 gluon, the 4 graviton scattering amplitude. And then beyond that, it just seems completely, totally hopeless. Okay. So you kind of get the impression when you first start learning quantum field theory that scalar theories are nice. Gluon theories are kind of more complicated. Too bad nature uses them. So we have to learn how to calculate these Feynman diagrams. And gravitons, just totally forget it. Gravity is clearly the most complicated theory. It'll have by far the most complicated scattering amplitudes. Feynman diagrams are totally hopeless. Like I said, your impression is, oh, well, too bad the world isn't scalar theories, okay? Well, you should then be particularly shocked by this formula. Not just because it's so simple, but because there's no analogously simple formula for scalars. Scalar amplitudes are complicated. There is no nice amplitude if I give you a theory with if I give you the analogous theory for scalars, which would just have as a basic vertex, this would be like a phi cube theory. Okay, the amplitudes for n scalars is a horrendously complicated mess. There's no closed form expression for it of any sort at all. Okay? So there's something very counterintuitive going on when you manage to actually compute them, by hook or by crook, you start noticing that the things that you thought were tremendously complicated are much simpler than the things that you naively thought were the simplest. And this actually, believe it or not, continues to extend to gravity. And gravity amplitudes seem to have some absolutely spectacular structures in them that you would not in a million years have expected from staring at the Feynman diagrams. Okay? So this seems to argue that there's something about the usual way of talking about field theory and Feynman diagrams that is totally obscuring some other aspect of the physics involving scattering. Okay? And well, what is the physical culprit for this? What is the physical culprit for the diagrams being so tremendously complicated? The physical culprit is locality. The diagrams got so complicated and have so much redundancy. They're so complicated because they have to have an enormous amount of redundancy in them. And they have to have that much redundancy in them because of our insistence on describing the physics in a way that's manifestly local. So this argues that perhaps there's another way of formulating and figuring out what scattering amplitudes are which will be exactly the same. It'll give you exactly the same answers. It should somehow make the simplicity of the answer much more manifest, and other properties much, much more manifest. And I should say that a lot of this has been discovered by people just improving the technology for computing amplitudes, and then discovering all sorts of more and more and more amazing properties of them, which were totally hidden in diagrams. Okay? And that really seems to argue that there should be some alternate formulation of this physics that doesn't make locality manifest, makes the structure of the answer manifest, but is, however, exactly equivalent, just a rewriting of the standard physics in a way that removes locality from its perch and makes other things more manifest. Yes?
Is analogous to the difference between electric field electrodynamics and action at a distance electrodynamics?
No, there is no such thing as action at a distance electrodynamics. I'm not sure what you mean.
You know, like Feynman-Wheeler formulation. It's like it's just charges.
Oh yeah. No, it's not really analogous to that. What the philosophy is actually really analogous to is the following. You see, let me come back to this at the end of the lecture today, because I think that there's a very, very important point of philosophy, but I want to get going a little more so you even know what these symbols mean, and appreciate a little more what is actually going on here. But I have to say that this is something, and it's a set of developments that I personally find incredibly exciting. Because it's as if we're learning something about the structure of theories we know for a fact describe the real world. Yang-Mills theory describes the real world. GR describes the real world. We thought we understood these theories 100 years ago, 50 years ago, but these things that have been sitting under our noses for 50 or 100 years have in them tremendous surprises and tremendous structures that are being totally obscured in the way we've learned to think about them. That's got to be important. That's got to be important, and it's got to be understood. And even though it involves a purely theoretical exploration, it's a theoretical exploration of things that describe the world, under the structures that describe the world. In fact, it's a lot like doing. It's a lot like having experiment. Okay, and a lot of the developments here happen by experimentalists. Experimentalists in this context were the people who, for a variety of reasons, some for practical reasons, for reasons of making predictions for accelerators, others because they were curious, started trying to figure out how to do the harder and harder Feynman diagram calculations. Okay? Now, you know, these were a group of people that I personally think are the real heroes of this business, because 15, 20 years ago, 25 years ago, they were just doing this hard work, right? They wanted to calculate 6 gluon scattering amplitudes, 5, 6, 6 gluons, 7 gluon scattering amplitudes. And, you know, you could have taken the attitude, which many people did, oh, you guys, yes, it's hard. You're computing these Feynman diagrams all the time. Why are you doing this? This is not the exciting stuff. We've understood Yang-Mills theory for 50 years. Give me a break. All the exciting stuff is elsewhere. Why are you doing this grunt work? And they said, no, we need to do this grunt work to make a prediction for accelerators. We need to do it for many, many reasons. We need to do it because doesn't it suck that we don't know how to do these calculations? So they had just a very pragmatic attitude that they wanted to learn how to actually extract these answers, right? And it shows you something. It shows you something very important. Only after you see what the answer looks like, if ever something is kind of a little shrouded in fog, and your first reaction is, well, it's probably not important, it's likely not a good reaction. And likely when you actually see what it looks like, you're going to learn something. Okay? This was the attitude of these people, and they heroically carried on this business when it was not very fashionable to do. But they started extracting using tricks other than Feynman diagrams. But you know, random trick here, random trick there, this way, that way. They started actually trying to get the answers out. And when you actually see what the amplitudes look like, is when you're like, holy crap! You know, that's surprising. I would have never thought in a million years that this should be a one-line expression, right? So they're extracting data about Yang-Mills theory and gravity. The act of doing these computations is getting data. Okay? Now, when you get enough of this data, you start looking for a pattern, and you start hunting for a theory. Okay? A theory, in this case, would be some completely alternate formulation of standard physics that should allow you to understand where all this incredible simplicity is coming from. And as I said, I think that this enterprise is deeply related to the set of questions that we started talking about, of trying to figure out how to talk about physics in a way that isn't manifestly local, precisely because all of these complications are a direct consequence of locality. Okay? So this is not yet banishing locality, because we're trying to describe, this is exactly local. This physics is exactly local. Okay? But we're trying to talk about it in a way that isn't manifestly local. And that will hopefully serve as a good jumping off point for figuring out how to get rid of locality altogether when these non-perturbative effects, gravitational effects, become important. Okay, so in order to do that, I have to explain to you what these symbols mean and how it's possible that for the first time you can actually see what the amplitudes look like. Okay, so yeah, one of the reasons why no one could have seen this before is because what you get from the Feynman diagram doesn't even care about the polarizations, right? You compute this thing, then you dot into polarizations. How do you know that when all the polarizations are plus, it's zero? When all are plus and one is minus, it's zero. I mean, all that difference between the polarizations is totally gone when you're doing it diagrammatically. Until you literally actually do it, you know, plug in the actual numerical values for the polarization vectors, you would discover this. But again, this very redundant way of talking about it is blocking you from seeing what they actually look like. So I'm going to tell you how to do that. And that's the purpose of the of the rest of this of this lecture. I want to first tell you how to do it by telling you a very nice way of thinking about the Lorentz group in four dimensions. Okay. As a very, very quick reminder, let me do the analogous thing first for rotations in three dimensions. So you all know that in three dimensions, when you first talk about rotations, in your mind, you're implicitly thinking about 3x3 matrices that act on vectors to give you other vectors, whose length is left invariant. Okay, so when you think about rotations in your mind, they're coming equipped with a representation in terms of 3x3 matrices acting on vectors. But you also all know that there is this two-dimensional representation for spin-a-half particles. It's possible to talk about how rotations act using 2x2 matrices. Okay. And it's related to the Pauli spin matrices and so on. Okay. So I want to remind you of a sort of particularly nice way of talking about that, which you many of you may have seen. But anyway, that way will port extremely nicely to talking about Lorentz transformations. Okay? So let's do the following. Let's say we have a vector x. It's three-dimensional vector x. I'm going to associate with this three-dimensional vector x, I'm going to associate with it a two-dimensional matrix, capital X, which is sigma dot little x. So if x is x, y, z, then capital X would be z, negative z, x plus I, y, x minus I, y. Okay. You will notice that capital X is a traceless and Hermitian matrix. In fact, it's a completely general traceless Hermitian matrix. Okay. Sorry?
Oh, yeah, I guess. I don't remember what the conventions are for the Pauli matrices. Yes?
The Pauli spin matrices.
Oh, okay. Sigma X, well, which I obviously don't remember. okay, these would be a topic. Yes?
Sorry to keep picking at little details with this, but I'm just trying to figure out your take. How are you getting a 2x2 matrix out of that dotting?
So this is sigma x plus sigma y plus sigma z.
Oh. Okay.
Okay.
That's I see.
Okay. So sigma z is z minus z. Sigma xx is xx. All right.
Sigmas are the basis for the algebra.
Sorry?
The sigma is the basis for the algebra of SU2.
They are, but they're also the Pauli spin matrices from kindergarten. is that clear? Is that sigma dot x clear? Yes.
No. Is this an actual inner product, or is this just notation?
It's sigma xx plus sigma yy plus sigma z.
Matrices and vector scale and scale.
But like they're not in the same space. Like you can't even.
We just taught the H matrix by the scale.
So sigmas are 2x2 matrices, okay. And they also carry a spatial index. They also carry a vector index. So I'm taking the dot product of the vector index. So, I mean, there's a sigma x, sigma y, sigma z, and so that x, y, z, 1, 2, 3 are just vector indices, and I'm taking the dot product with respect to that vector. I literally mean this. If I had never said this, I could also say, I'm going to take the vector x, y, z, and I'm going to package the same information, x, y, z, into a 2x2 matrix, a traceless 2x2 matrix in the following way, z minus z, x plus i, y, x minus, oh, geez, x plus i, y. Okay? So I'm just saying, associate with a three-dimensional vector the following two-dimensional matrix with exactly the same information content. Okay. Now, notice something cool about the matrix capital X. What is its determinant? Its determinant is negative z squared, negative x squared plus y squared, otherwise known as negative the magnitude of x squared. Okay? So just keep that in mind. Now, let me consider some linear transformations on X, okay, which keep a traceless Hermitian matrix to be a traceless Hermitian matrix. Okay? So that's a transformation which is just a unitary transformation on X. X goes to U dagger X U. If X is a traceless Hermitian matrix, then U dagger XU is also a traceless Hermitian matrix. It's clearly Hermitian, and it's clearly also traceless, because if I took the trace of this guy, then I can just move the U over to this side, UU dagger is 1, and the trace is invariant. Okay? So that means that if this X is sigma dot X, then U dagger XU is sigma dot sum X prime. It's another traceless Hermitian matrix. So I can write it as sigma dot sum X prime. However, determinant of u dagger xu is also equal to the determinant of x. Right? So that means that negative x prime squared is equal to negative x squared. That means that this new vector x prime is just a rotation on the vector x. That rotation depends on what this u is. But it's a rotation. So we've discovered how to implement rotations on a two-dimensional space. Okay? And you can invert this. A general three-dimensional, conversely, a general three-dimensional rotation maps one 2x2 matrix to another 2x2 matrix with a unitary transformation. So this is how you can discover the two-dimensional representation of the rotations in three dimensions using this simple little observation. Yes?
So is the, you know, is the group of two-dimensional complex rotations precisely the same as the group of three-dimensional real rotations? Is the group of three-dimensional real rotations precisely the same as the group of two-dimensional complex rotations, or is it just a representation of it in the group of?
The actual groups are identical.
Okay. I mean,
you see, this is just a SU group, right? This is just a unitary. It's just
yeah.
Unitary matrix. Yes.
SU2 is.
Yes. I'm only talking about things close to the identity. Okay. So not once in these lectures am I going to talk about big topological things, because we would spend an entire day on it, and it's a little bit boring. If this is all things that are close to the identity, blah blah blah. So yes. Any other questions? Okay. All right, now we're going to repeat this exercise for the Lorentz group. And you'll see how much more natural the Lorentz group is even than rotations. So what I'm going to now do is instead of, I am going to have an x mu, which is x0 and x. Let me introduce a notation sigma mu, where the zero component is the 2x2 matrix 1, and the other components are the Pauli spin matrices x. Maybe I'll put a minus sign here. Okay. Now let me consider the object x mu sigma mu. So this is explicitly x0 plus x3, x0 minus x3, x1. Can you remind me again what was plus or minus up there? Thank you. It's kind of weird, isn't it? I guess. No? Okay. Let's call this matrix capital X again. Now, capital X is a completely general Hermitian matrix, a completely general 2x2 Hermitian matrix. For heaven's sake. yes, they're fine, because of my metric. Huh? No, I've written it with a sigma with a lower mu already. Good point. Thank you. Yes, thank you very much. Now everything's okay, right? Okay, very good. All right. Everyone's so happy? Okay. It's a completely general 2x2 matrix. Now, let's look at the determinant of capital X. The determinant of capital X is that product, which is x0 squared minus x3 squared minus x1 squared plus x2 squared. Oh, geez. Why am I doing it like this? Should I put these indices downstairs? This is so lame. I did it because these squares are stacking up on the twos. Oh, Christ, 6, 3, 2. Very good, okay? I don't want to hear any lip out of any of you. All right? Yes?
It's not lip, I swear. Was just going to ask, when you say it's a completely general 2x2 Hermitian matrix,
yes,
do you mean that any...
Any 2x2 Hermitian matrix is of this form, right?
Okay, but...
any 2x2 Hermitian matrix...
But how do you get an imaginary component on the diagonals there?
It's not imaginary. These are real. X0 plus X3, X0 minus X3.
Right, but if it's if you have some...
If it's Hermitian, there is no imaginary components on the diagonal. Okay? Hermitian matrix are real on the diagonal. Okay?
Yep. Sorry.
So the reason this is totally... So a totally general Hermitian matrix would be A, B... you know, Z plus IW, Z minus IW, right?
Yeah, it's just beta. Sorry.
And all I'm saying is that you can write A and B if you want as X0 plus X3 and X0 minus X3, okay? All right, so anyway, this is clearly X squared. So this is clearly the Lorentzian X squared. Okay? So now let's look at the set of all linear transformations that can map a completely general Hermitian matrix into itself. Okay? And those linear transformations are X goes to, and I'll write it as L dagger X L. Okay? Now, L is any 2x2 complex matrix which has determinant 1. So let me take L to be any 2x2 complex matrix. And in a second, we'll see why I want it to have a determinant 1. So it doesn't have to be unitary. Okay? Yes?
Takes X to itself, takes X to another.
Yeah, sorry, that takes one completely general 2x2 Hermitian matrix to another completely general 2x2. So L does not have to be unitary anymore. Okay? And so let's see, I mean, so the one thing the unitarity was buying us before is that it guaranteed that the trace was preserved. Okay? Well, the trace won't be preserved by this, and that's fine, because the matrix wasn't traceless to begin with. Okay? So this is any 2x2 complex matrix. Now, why do I want it to have determinant 1? Because if it has determinant 1, then determinant of X is equal to determinant of L dagger X L. Okay? So the extension of the Lorentz group, the way it acts on spin a half, The extension of rotations of the Lorentz group, there continues to be a two-dimensional representation. And the two-dimensional representation is in terms of 2x2 complex matrices of unit determinant. Okay? So you will see this notation all the time, just so you see what the names mean, people will say GL2C, for example. Okay? GL2C, the G stands for general. General linear 2x2 matrices that are complex. Okay? So that's what this notation means. But that's not what we have. We have SL2C. The S stands for special linear transformations of two-dimensional complex matrices. Okay? The special in this business always means determinant 1. So we've learned that the Lorentz group is SL2C. And we found a two-dimensional representation of it. Okay. So let me say this a little more abstractly. Let's say I have a general 2x2 matrix L alpha beta. Okay? So alpha and beta are run from 1 to 2. Alpha, beta, these kind of indices run from 1 to 2. Okay? Then there is an action of the Lorentz group on objects that have these kind of indices, okay, have index alpha. And the action is psi prime alpha is equal to L alpha beta psi beta. Okay. So this is a spinner representation of the Lorentz group. Now, actually, there is another representation, a different representation. Because if L is an element of SL2C, so is L star, the complex conjugate of L. Okay? The complex conjugate of L is another 2x2 matrix of determinant 1. Okay? So I can transform objects according to L. That's one representation. I can also transform them according to the complex conjugate of L. That's another representation. So people, just for historical reasons, use a notation to distinguish the complex conjugate L star. Okay? This thing is written as if you like, as L star. But we changed the indices by putting a dot on them. Okay. So we just want to denote the different representations. The things that transform according to L are given the indices alpha. The things that transform with L star are given the indices alpha dot. So we write sigma prime, and the analogous objects, we put a bar on them. So psi bar prime alpha dot is L star alpha dot beta dot psi bar beta dot. So this is one spinner representation, and this is the other spinner representation. They're complex conjugates of each other. Okay? Yeah?
What do the dotted indices mean, though? I'm a little confused, sorry.
Well, so they're nothing other than... So when you see some index, how you label it is just a convenient way of remembering how it's going to transform when you do a Lorentz transformation. Okay? So Lorentz transformation is associated with some matrix, right? L. The only question is, when you see something, do you transform it with L or do you transform it with L star? I could just write them all with the same kind of indices and then just by hand keep writing down how they transform, putting with some L and with some L star. It's just useful to put a dot over the ones that go with L star, just so I remember. Whenever I see a dot, that guy's going with L star. Alpha dot runs to, goes over 1, 2, just as much as alpha goes over 1, 2. Okay? They're both two-dimensional indices. It's just that when you write it down with a dot, it reminds you that it transforms like that. In particular, the matrices that we just talked about, these sigma mu matrices that we talked about, remember, I can think that sigma mu is going like L sigma mu, L dagger sigma mu L. Right? And so, in fact, you can think of sigma mu as having an alpha and then alpha dot index. Because on the left, it's being transformed by L star, and on the right, it's being transformed by L. Okay? Or I guess this way, I would say it's an alpha dot L, but it doesn't matter anyway. Okay? Okay. Very good. So in fact, let me be more specific. If I take sigma mu dotted into any vector, this thing, I can think of having an alpha and an alpha dot index. Okay, so this is the two-dimensional representation of the Lorentz group. And just as for rotations, this two-dimensional spin a half representation is the most fundamental one, and you can build up everything else from them. Okay. So, but I won't talk about that here. I'll instead, let's just zoom on to what this is actually going to be useful for us for. So let's go back now and talk about massless particles. So if I have massless particles, there's a momentum, p mu, and p squared is equal to 0. Okay. So we've just seen that it's very useful to look at the 2x2 matrix associated with p. Okay, so let's look at the 2x2 matrix associated with p. So let me look at sigma dot p, right? This thing that we just talked about. So instead of writing sigma dot p, I can also write this as p alpha alpha dot. Exactly the same thing. Okay? But whichever way I do it, this 2x2 matrix satisfies that the determinant of sigma dot p, which is minus p squared, is 0. So that tells you that this 2x2 matrix has vanishing determinant. OK, so what does that tell you about what the matrix looks like? If a 2x2 matrix has vanishing determinant, then the matrix has to have rank 1, right? Well, it's either 0, the matrix is either 0, or it should have rank 1. If it has rank 1, what that means is that it's the product of a vector and another vector. Right? So in other words, p alpha alpha dot has to be the product of two vectors. Let me call them one of them lambda alpha, and I'll call the other one lambda twiddle alpha dot. Oh, so let's see. A completely general 2x2 matrix is of the form, I mean, a totally general matrix, a completely general matrix Mij, if it had rank 1, would be some vector W times some vector V times some vector W. If you have a bunch of them, so a totally general matrix, if this is n by n, would be some vector n, some vector wn. Okay. This is a totally general n by n matrix is of this form. After all, totally general n by n matrix should have the property that, you know, you, a more familiar case that you're used to is when this is a Hermitian matrix. When it's a Hermitian matrix, you are used to doing things like writing M is the sum of n, n, where these are some eigenstates of something times some eigenvalues, right? But again, this is the sum, it's the outer product of two vectors. And the sum over n of them, the outer product of two vectors. Okay? So if the determinant of a matrix vanishes, let's for a second imagine that it's Hermitian. This is Hermitian as well. But if it vanishes, then one of these eigenvalues is zero. At least one of them is zero. And therefore, this is the sum over n minus one vectors of something times n, n. In fact, the something I can absorb into the vector itself if I don't demand that the vector has unit norm. Okay? So in this case, it's a two-dimensional. It's a 2x2 matrix. If it has determinant 0, then it has to be just a single vector times its complex conjugate. Okay? So I'm writing it this way. For a reason, yes. So for real momentum, which is all the things that we've been talking about so far, for real momenta, indeed, lambda twiddle alpha dot is lambda alpha star. Okay. Yes.
So another way to say to write what you said is it's the product of the you know, the dual of, it's like lambda times, how do I say this? You know what I mean? It's something that takes, that spits out lambda multiplied by the dual of lambda applied to whatever vector you put in.
Right. I mean, so in the case where P is Hermitian, which is, again, so far everything we've been doing, this is absolutely nothing other than what you're used to in quantum mechanics. Okay. So it's just the exercise that we just did, just that little enough.
So for sure you have to use the inner product here to find the dual. Like,
huh?
This is the dual induced by the inner product. You have to have.
So in fact, you don't need that. You don't need that much information. But in the particular case where it's a Hermitian matrix, then that would give it to you. But you don't need that much information. So in fact, the thing that you're used to from quantum mechanics is an N and an N there. For a totally general non-Hermitian matrix, you can write it that way with an N and an N. Okay. I keep
making the exception for this being a Hermitian matrix and real momenta, because a big deal is going to be that we're going to soon think about complex momenta, even though we're not, you know, you're not strictly allowed to. But you're allowed to do anything you want. But but for real ordinary momenta, this is what it is. Let's actually just descend very quickly, just to see exactly what this is. Let's imagine we have a particle moving in the z direction. Okay, if we have a particle, massless particle moving in the z direction, then what is this matrix? This matrix is like E plus pz, E minus pz, 0 and 0. And let's say it's moving in the plus z direction, then the matrix would actually be 2e, 0, 0, 0. That's the two-dimensional matrix. So what is lambda in this case? So lambda is equal to square root 2e0. And lambda twiddle would also be square root 2e0. Okay? That's all it is. And in fact, we can get what it is for any particle by just applying the SL2C transformation to these guys. All right. Now, if lambda tilde alpha dot is not forced to be lambda alpha star, then this matrix is not Hermitian. And that means that I'm talking about a completely general complex matrix of the form sigma mu p mu. So I'm imagining that the momentum components could be totally complex. Now, the real case, they're real, and lambda tilde is equal to lambda star. But it's going to be convenient for us to imagine lambda tilde and lambda being independent variables in a lot of what we're doing. In the end of the day, we'll force them lambda tilde to be lambda star, but it's going to be very convenient to imagine that they're general complex variables. All right. Now, let's say I have, let's back up for a second, and let's say I have some vector psi alpha, psi 1 alpha, some two-dimensional vector psi 1 alpha, another two-dimensional vector psi 2 alpha. Okay? It's very simple to build out of these things Lorentz invariants. Okay? So we're used to building Lorentz invariants out of dotting things together with eta mu nu and metric tensors and so on. There's even simpler Lorentz invariants that we can build out of these two-dimensional objects. Okay? So these guys transform under SL2C. Okay? What is a general, just think geometrically for a second, these SL transformations are just linear transformations that preserve the determinant. Okay? So what kind of invariants can I build? Well, all you can do, so let's say in a general space, I have a bunch of, there's a general n-dimensional space. I have a bunch of vectors living in this n-dimensional space. And I want to have things that are invariant under linear transformations of determinant 1. They're all volumes. Okay? All I can do is take the volume that you build out of, if I have 100 vectors, I'm in a 7-dimensional space, I can take any 7 of them and look at the volume that's made with those 7. Okay? So in general, a better way of saying this is that there's an invariant tensor, which is the epsilon tensor. Okay? It's a totally antisymmetric tensor. And so you can build invariants by contracting vector indices with the epsilon tensor, the totally invariant tensor. Now, in two dimensions, this is particularly simple. The volume is just the area made up by the two vectors. Okay? And so the invariant that I can build, which I can write psi 1, psi 2, is just epsilon alpha beta, psi 1 alpha, psi 2 beta. Okay? This is invariant under SL2C, where here epsilon alpha beta is, you know, is 0 if alpha equals beta, 1 if alpha equals 1, beta equals 2, and minus 1 if alpha equals 2, beta equals 1. Okay? Sorry? No, I'm not summing on that. No, I'm summing on these guys, but I'm not putting in.
The other way around as well, then.
Hmm? You do. No. This is just my definition of what this inner product is. Okay. This is an invariant that I can build out of them, which I will label. In fact, let me use a better label. I will label them psi 1, psi 2, with an angle bracket. Okay. The angle bracket is associated with the alpha indices. Similarly, if I have a psi bar 1 alpha dot, and a psi bar 2 alpha dot, then I can build something that I will call psi bar 1, psi bar 2, with the square bracket, which is epsilon alpha dot beta dot, psi bar 1 alpha dot, psi bar 2 beta dot. So it's extremely simple to build invariants out of these vectors. Just take the, take angle and square brackets made of size with size and sidebars with sidebars. Okay. So I should have said that. Okay. So let's now go back here. And so I just told you that I can, with any momentum, p, I can associate a lambda and a lambda twiddle. Okay? But I slightly lied to you. Well, I didn't lie yet. Because you see, this choice of lambda isn't unique. I can't uniquely associate a lambda with a p. After all, if I have any lambda and lambda twiddle that works, then if I send lambda to some phase times lambda, so lambda twiddle, since it's the complex conjugate, at least for real momenta, would go to e to the minus I theta times lambda twiddle, then I get the same p. Okay? This is actually really good news. You'll see why it's really good news in a second. So let me try to do something. Let me try to define one canonical way of associating a lambda and a lambda tilde with a p. Okay. Let me do it in the following way. Let me pick some Well, I mean, this just says that when I say p is lambda lambda tilde, the lambdas aren't uniquely defined. Okay, so there's a whole family of lambdas that give me the same p.
But now what are we doing?
Now I'm going to at least try to pick one representative from that family. Okay, I'm just going to pick one. I'll just manually pick one, and I will do it like this. I will do it, and this part of the discussion will sound a little familiar to those of you who were yesterday afternoon. Let me do it by picking some particular momentum k, and I will define lambda k alpha dot. Okay, I'll just pick one that I like. For example, that k could have been the one that we just talked about, and the lambda could just be the one that we wrote down, root 2e 0. There too, I could have multiplied root 2e by a phase on one, and by the opposite phase on the other. Okay, but let me just choose one. Okay. Now, let me take any other momentum, which is some Lorentz transformation acting on k. Okay, I can get to every other light-like momentum by doing some Lorentz transformation on k. Okay. This Lorentz transformation, let just remind myself that it's supposed to take me to p. Okay, so it's starting from k, and it's supposed to take me to p, sorry. And now let me call this lambda p. I will simply define lambda alpha for the momentum p to just be the SL2C transformation associated with this Lorentz transformation acting on lambda beta for k. Okay? So what I'm doing is defining it, just what we said a second ago, right? I'm defining it for one special vector, and then just boosting it from there to define it for all vectors. So this at least gives me some canonical choice for what I mean by the lambdas. However, having made this choice, something very amusing happens. Having made this choice, you can see that it is not true that if I look at lambda for some general Lorentz transformation, maybe I shouldn't have called that. Too many things. Some general Lorentz transformation lambda on p. This is not equal to the SL2C transformation acting on that. You see, what I did is start from a reference vector, define everyone else by boosting using SL2C from that reference vector. Now I've defined specifically what it is for everybody. Okay? But now it is not true that if you now look at, if you start from one guy and you go to another, it is not true that all I have to do is do an SL2C transformation. Okay? In fact, it would have been a little surprising if that's all you had to do, given that you know that there is this freedom to multiply by a phase. Okay? In fact, what you can show happens, and I'll leave this as an exercise for you, what you can show happens is that instead it is equal to this multiplied by a phase factor that depends on what lambda and p are. Okay? Yes?
Sorry. I don't understand this last step where you're going from.
You see, what I did here is give, pick a way of associating lambdas with all momentum. Okay? So now I'm done. Now I know exactly what I mean by, when I just wrote p equals lambda lambda tilde, I'm not done. There's an ambiguity for what lambda I should assign for a given p. So what I did is just pick one. I picked one set of lambdas associated with some p. And the way I did it is pick one for a given momentum, and then take that momentum and boost it anywhere I want, and find its associated lambda by taking the lambda that I started with for the first momentum and using this, the 2x2 matrix associated with that boost. Okay? So that defines it everywhere. So now I've defined the lambda. I've picked some way of associating a lambda with all the p's. But having done that, it is not true that the lambda of the Lorentz transformed P is just the corresponding 2x2 matrix multiplied by the lambda.
You might have
very naively thought that the lambda of the Lorentz transform momentum, I've just done a Lorentz transformation on the momentum. So you know that these Lorentz transformations are just given by 2x2 matrices on these two dimensional vectors. Okay. So you might have thought that lambda associated with the transform momentum is just that 2x2 is just the associated 2x2 matrix times lambda with the original momentum. Okay. And it had certainly better be this up to a phase. Okay. Because we know that the momentum So we know that lambda times lambda tilde should be lambda p. So, and this is the 2x2 matrix which is implementing the Lorentz transformation lambda on these two-dimensional vectors. It just so happens that having fixed all these phase, another way of saying it is having fixed all these phase conventions in one Lorentz frame, in another Lorentz frame, it's not guaranteed that everything is going to have the same phase. That's all this is saying, right? This is saying that we fixed this phase convention. I said, for example, I said that that when it's moving in the z direction, it's root 2e 0 with no phase there. That's in some Lorentz frame, right? I picked some Lorentz frame, and in that Lorentz frame, I've said there's no phases. In that Lorentz frame, I define what it is for all the other momenta. And so for all the other momenta, there won't be relative phases. Okay? But now, if I did the entire thing in another Lorentz frame, then there could be relative phases. And that's just what you discover when you do this. Yes?
Just to make sure I understand, the initial Lorentz frame you pick is whatever's convenient.
Whatever's convenient, that's right. So there's no canonical meaning to it at all. There's no canonical meaning. I just pick one.
Is there a convention when we do?
No, not particularly. So we could just do the one we did. Right? You see, this is fascinating because this is exactly what we wanted to find for polarization vectors. The analog of what we want to find for polarization vectors. Remember, we wanted something that had the property that when you did a Lorentz transformation, it had two kinds of indices, right? And the part of it transformed like a Lorentz transformation, but the rest of it picked up a phase factor.
Okay? So we scrapped that.
Now, polarization vectors don't exist.
However, these objects, and they're called spinner helicity variables, for obvious reasons, they're spinners, and as we'll see in a second, they're associated with the helicity as well. These are nice objects. These are objects which transform under Lorentz transformations and pick up a phase factor. Okay? And that phase factor is precisely the phase factor that you would associate with the helicity of a particle of spin a half, of a massive particle of spin a half. Yes?
So is this phase factor coming in because if you want to go from like lambda p to lambda of lambda p,
yeah.
you can kind of go back to the base of lambda k?
Yes, exactly. You have to go back and you have to go back and go forward again. Exactly. Okay. Precisely, yes. So that's a nice exercise that you can do. You can even do with a specific example, just to see where these phases come. Okay. So this means something rather remarkable. It means that let's say I have particles one, two, and a bunch of other particles. Let's focus on one and two. Okay? Then if I look at the object lambda one, lambda two, which I remind you is epsilon alpha beta, lambda 1 alpha, lambda 2 beta. Okay. This is something which is Lorentz invariant, right? Under the SL2C, it's invariant. But not quite. Under Lorentz transformations, it goes into itself up to a phase factor. Some e to the I theta 1, e to the I theta 2. And these are precisely the phase factors that you'd associate with. These are precisely the phase factor you'd associate, we say by convention, with a particle of helicity minus 1 half. Okay? It's a particle of, it's got spin a half. Just by convention, we say the lambdas are associated with helicity negative half. Similarly, lambda 1, lambda 2 would go to e to the minus I theta 1, e to the minus I theta 2. Okay. And this is what we would have associated with helicity plus a half.
Is there any reason why half and not plus one and minus one?
Yes, because this is a two-dimensional representation. Okay, so these factors would be associated with particles of spin a half. Okay. So that's just that. So the actual spin of the particles, the actual helicity they have, are spin a half with these guys. Okay. But now we've learned something very, very, very nice. There is a way of writing amplitudes directly, not in a redundant way where you write tensors and dot them into polarization vectors. Amplitudes of helicity h1 up to hn, we used to write them as a function of momenta. Now we can write them instead as a function of lambda 1, lambda tilde 1, lambda 2, lambda tilde 2, up to lambda n and lambda tilde n. Okay? The statement, first of all, is that this had better be invariant under the Lorentz transformations on the SL2C indices of lambda and lambda tilde. Okay? So this had better be built out of things that look like ij and ij, and so on. But secondly, it had better have the property that the actual Lorentz transformations is the property that if I take any one, so let's say I take this to be e to the I theta 1 lambda 1, e to the minus I theta 1 lambda tilde 1, e to the I theta 2 lambda 2, e to the minus I theta 2 lambda tilde 2, and so on, that I had better get from this e to the I well, 2h1 e to the I 2h2 up to e to the I 2hn m of lambda 1, lambda tilde 1, up to lambda n, lambda tilde n. I put a 2 here because if these helicities are a half, then what we said is that lambda goes to e to the I theta lambda corresponds to spin a half. Okay. So, e to the I 2h1 theta 1, 2h2 theta 2, 2hn theta n. So a scattering amplitude is a function of these variables, is directly a function of these variables, lambda and lambda tilde, but it has to have a certain homogeneity property. It has to have a certain scaling property that under scaling any given lambda, if you have a particle of helicity h, if you scale its lambda and its lambda tilde by opposite phases, the amplitude has to be multiplied by an overall factor e to the I 2h times that. So let's see how this works in one of the examples that I showed you, just so you get a feeling for it. Remember I said that when you have amplitudes, we looked at this example, right? 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6. And I forget which one I did. Plus, 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 minus, plus, minus. Let's say we do that one, okay? Then I told you that this amplitude is 3, 5 to the fourth over 1, 2, 2, 3, 3, 4, 4, 5, 5, 6, 6, 1. Okay. By the way, 3, 5 really means lambda 3, lambda 5. Okay, but I'm abbreviating that to 3, 5. So let's see, does this satisfy this? Well, if I were to rescale 3 by e to the I theta times 3, then what do I get? There's 4 threes upstairs, and there's 2 threes downstairs. Okay. So under lambda 3 goes to e to the I theta lambda 3, m goes to e to the plus 2i theta m. Okay. Oh, sorry, I should have put minus signs here because of the way I defined things for negative helicity. Sorry. M goes to e to the 2i theta m. Well, that's exactly right. This is e to the negative 2 times see, I'm measuring helicities and units of a half here. So just give me a that's right. So this is twice what you get for a negative helicity particle of spin a half, which is a negative particle, which is helicity negative 1. I'm just trying to decide how to write this in my notation so I don't have stupid 2s all over the place. No, it's right. I'm sorry. Yes, it's exactly right. Because the helicity here would be 1. Okay. So that's exactly right. So I did it right there. Okay. So this is e to the negative 2, as I'm supposed to have there, negative I 2 times negative 1 theta m. Okay, so that's a particle of helicity minus 1. That's what it is. 3 is helicity minus 1. Exactly the same argument for 5, right? What about particle 1? If I rescale lambda 1 to, and by the way, I should be rescaling also lambda tilde 3 close to e to the minus I theta lambda tilde 3. It just so happens rather peculiarly that this amplitude doesn't depend on lambda tilde at all. It only depends on lambdas and not lambda tildes. That's not a general fact. It's a very special fact of these kinds of amplitudes. But anyway, it makes it particularly easy to keep track of this. Okay? So if I look at particle 1, then there's just two 1s downstairs. So if I do the same scaling, I get e to the negative 2i theta, which is what you get corresponding to helicity plus 1. Okay? So this is a nice object which has the correct it says a nice object that has all the correct scalings in order for it to be in order to have the correct Lorentz transformation properties to be called an amplitude for this particular helicity configuration. Yes?
Can you say again why the amplitude has to be built out of in the products?
Because it has to be invariant under SL2C. It has to be invariant under the Lorentz group. It's Lorentz invariant up to these phases. That's what it has to do. When you do a Lorentz transformation on it, all it can do is pick up these phase factors. So that means that all of the alpha and alpha dot indices have to be eaten up. Okay? All you're left with are, and all you're left with is a very simple way of, you just have to count the net number, the net weight under rescaling lambda and lambda tilde oppositely tells you the helicity of the particle. Okay? But it's just, this is just Lorentz invariance. You know, if I wrote down an amplitude for scalars, you would expect it to be a function of p1 dot p2, p1 dot p4. Okay? This is the analog of that. It's just functions of Lorentz invariant inner products, but it has an overall weight under rephasing these variables, which is accounting correctly for the helicity of the particles. Yes.
So you said you got the from the on the right half of the board. From step 1 to step 2 by using the fact that it has to be built out of these inner products?
Yes.
Can you also do it from the fact that, like, because M is, you know, the inner product of two vectors, it has to be sort of quadratic? And
what has to be quadratic?
Like M. Like if you write a vector, so M is, what? You know, an amplitude, right? It's
the M is the amplitude, yes, that's right.
So if, like, you scale, like if you write those two things in terms of bases, and then you like scale the, you know, like one thing is, how do I say, like a transformation is going to be linear in quantum mechanics, but then if you take the amplitude will be like quadratic.
Mm-hmm. That's a way of thinking about it. That's
okay.
Right. So this is just another way. This is just the difference between the active and passive transformation.
Okay.
It's no different. So one way of saying is if you act the Lorentz transformation on the initial state, it multiplies the initial state by a phase.
Okay.
And so it had better be that you pick up the correct phase.
So even if you didn't know that M would have to be built out of those things, you could still do this?
No, this statement has nothing to do with that.
Okay.
Okay? This is just so this is true.
Okay.
In fact, let me say it another way. I should say it like this. Let me say it like this to be much, much clearer. Yes. Sure. Yeah.